The stage is set for a transportation infrastructure dialogue in Washington, D.C. after this week's successful White House meeting between President Trump and congressional Democrats. Going in, the national media mused the event would lead to a blow-up between the two sides. They reminded audiences the last meeting between these parties led to the longest government shutdown ever. But even as news coverage seemed to forecast failure, the opposite came true. Direct from the conversation in the White House cabinet room came this announcement, courtesy House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
A productive meeting with the President of the United States. We came to this meeting with an understanding that there is great need in our country for rebuilding our infrastructure, with a recognition that we stand at a pivotal place in terms of building infrastructure for the future. It's about jobs, jobs, jobs. It's about promoting commerce. It's about clean air, clean water. It's therefore a public health issue. It's a quality of life issue, getting people out of their cars, not being on the road so much. And in every way, it's a safety issue. So we're very excited about the conversation that we had with the president to advance an agenda of that kind.
And we talked about a number of things we would do. Obviously, the roads and the bridges and the highways, obviously water, but also a big emphasis on broadband, that every American home, we believe, needs broadband, an emphasis on the power grid so we could bring clean energy from one end of the country to the other, and several other issues. We told the president that we needed his ideas on funding, that the last bill he proposed, which A, was smaller, but B, took as much money away, and the speaker emphasized this, took as much money away as it put in, wasn't going to work. So where does he propose that we can fund this? Because certainly in the Senate, if we don't have him on board, it'll be very hard to get the Senate to go along. And we said we would meet in 3 weeks, and he would present to us some of his ideas on funding. So this was a very, very good start, and we'll see. We hope it will go to a constructive conclusion.
This is Hard Facts. I'm Robert Johnson. It's the breakthrough the nation has been waiting for, nearly 2.5 years in the making. The president and congressional Democrats signaling a desire to work together. It's true the White House, at the time this show was recorded, had yet to respond. In this case, no news would appear to be good news. With the report of cooperation and the president's plan to have another meeting in 3 weeks holding strong. Robert Thomas is president of the National Concrete Masonry Association. His members are among those tracking this week's meeting, eager to know what might happen at the next get-together where the president's funding ideas will be front and center. Shortly, we'll get to his view of Washington from across the Potomac River in Metro Virginia, but first, a quick primer on the organization.
So National Concrete Masonry Association represents the manufacturers of concrete masonry products. So for concrete masonry products, those are individual concrete units that I would describe as being made using dry cast concrete. So, you know, all concrete materials are made out of the same basic ingredients, right? It's Portland cement and aggregates. As well as water and any other admixtures that might go into making the product. But ours is made with very little water, and it's placed into a form in a automated machinery type of an equipment that has the ability to vibrate it and compact it so that it immediately is stripped from the mold and is able to retain its shape and flow down the assembly line and then go through a separate curing process before it gets placed onto a truck and shipped to the job site.
What does it look like?
Well, it can take a variety of shapes and sizes. I think the one that most people would be familiar with would be a concrete block. So once upon a time referred to as a cinder block, although we really don't use that terminology anymore because we're not using cinders as an aggregate to manufacture them. But a concrete block is, you know, most people have seen those before. But they can be a wide range of sizes and shapes, but most of them are still to the size that they can be handled individually by hand and placed in along with all the other units to form assemblies out at the job site.
Most of the folks that we're talking with have work in the transportation infrastructure world, so they're helping build bridges, they're providing materials for highways. Do your members do that, or do they do more than that?
Well, we do supply some products that are used in what I would refer to as those transportation applications. We do make segmental retaining wall units that would be used for bridge abutments, could be used for sound barrier walls, those types of things, as well as we also make articulated concrete block units that would be used for erosion control for, say, stream protection, levees, those types of things. But most of the products that we would manufacture would probably not go into transportation markets.
They would just go everywhere else.
Exactly, everywhere else. And so the market that we would be used predominantly in would be in building construction, everything from residential construction to municipal, industrial types of construction, commercial office buildings and schools and dormitories and those types of structures.
How does Washington impact your work, the work of your members?
Well, I think Washington affects everybody. Isn't that right?
I think most people would agree, some happily, some not so.
Yeah, so, certainly all of the business regulations, all the things that affect businesses in general would also affect the members of NCMA. There are areas that in some ways that we would like to encourage the policy directive personnel in Washington to address some issues in different ways. And in some ways for us, it's not those that directly affect our membership, but those that affect the public. And because we believe that the products that we manufacture have a role to play for the communities and where people live and work and play. And different policies can affect the way that those structures are put together. So for us, one of our big primary issues is addressing resilience. So resilience, as we define it, is really the ability for a community to get back on its feet after some kind of a disaster. I mean, we're used to thinking of natural disasters, which could be earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, fires. You know, if you look across the board, the frequency of those disasters are just continuing to increase, and the intensity is increasing, and therefore the cost to rebuild and the economic losses are just becoming staggering.
Does federal policy affect that? I mean, aren't those normally issues left to local jurisdictions? Explain that, sort of break it down for us.
Well, certainly there's policies that come into play at all kinds of levels. And so some losses, federal policy practically doesn't touch at all. So if you look at, say, individual building fires, those are individual discrete elements that happen for whatever causes and whatever reasons. So the building code might address something like building fires. And the building code is really developed outside of the federal government. And so we work within those environments to try to establish what would be appropriate building code requirements. But there are also the ability for the federal government to influence how those codes are developed and what should be kind of set as the standard norm of acceptability. Because building codes are really developed as life safety codes. So life safety means that you really just want to make sure that the inhabitants of a building have the ability to get out and evacuate to the point where a collapse or damage to that structure does not result in loss of life. But if you look at cases like hurricanes, the presumption is that people are evacuating. And so they really don't care about what happens to the structure as long as people have the ability to get out. Our arguments are that we need a new paradigm in terms of how we look at the way that those buildings should perform, because communities are impacted and there's huge costs associated with building failures. And the dynamics that we have in terms of what might affect the decisions that are made into what goes into a building, the players that are involved in that process have their own incentives for taking the positions that they do. And a lot of it is cost, granted. And so concrete materials have the ability to provide much greater protection, but they also may cost a little bit. But the question is, does the federal government need to get involved a little bit in setting what a standard of care should be? Because otherwise the losses just become too great and we spend far too much money in post-disaster recovery as opposed to pre-disaster mitigation.
Is that your ask of Congress then when it comes to the topic of resiliency?
Absolutely. And the numbers are staggering, and there's lots of people that have gotten involved in this, lots of organizations and forums that are starting to have some of these discussions. The numbers that you can quote that are out there are for every dollar that's spent in mitigation, you have the ability to save $6 to $8 in terms of post-disaster recovery expenses. But in reality, for every dollar that we're spending on pre-disaster, we're really spending $14 in post-disaster. There's an economic benefit for investing up front, but the challenge is spending it up front, right? It's the same thing as a transportation argument, is we know that if we spend the money in advance, then we're actually going to have long-term economic benefit for that.
Yeah, you can pay now or you can pay a lot more later.
Absolutely. That's the crux of the issue. And it's hard to come up with those dollars. We get that. But if you're truly being a steward of the resources that you have available to you, sometimes you have to address that political challenge and figure out how to allocate those resources, because you're going to spend it anyway.
Now, a lot of what Washington does is really not that popular anywhere else in America. So how do you sell that to the 50 states, to all of the jurisdictions that are doing this regulatory work with their building codes and their zoning plans? How does a federal overlay work in their world? How do you convince them that it's a good idea?
Well, we really got off to a great start, I would say, this past year when Congress passed the DRRA, or the Disaster Recovery and Reform Act. And that really was a clear indication that the policymakers realized that there were things that they could do differently to support and encourage disaster mitigation. And so they've got some new grant funding programs that are out there. They've got some incentives for states to adopt more recent and better model building codes. But you're right, the local enforcement issues are kind of interesting, because you can have the greatest building code in the world, but if you don't have adequate resources to support the inspection and the permitting side, you have the potential that you can build structures that aren't in full compliance. So it's a complicated issue, but just by gauging on the number of pieces of legislation and the number of organizations that are involved, you begin to get the sense that the policymakers are really beginning to own up to the fact that they do have a role to play at the national level for this.
I suppose you might be able to encourage participation by tying federal disaster aid to some sort of robust plan that says if you are working with us on this and doing more, then, you know, should disaster strike, the funds are there at this level. If not, you know, maybe they come in lower. I mean, you're going to have to find some way to incentivize that, I think, right, to get people to come along, because generally mandates of any kind are, you know, taboo for most folks in the rest of the country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, some of the more recent disasters, such as Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast, really kind of changed a lot of the equation of the way that people looked at some of these natural disasters that are on a big scope, if you will. So, you know, before that, it was a lot of hurricanes in the Southeast. But once you had a big hurricane that really affected a wide swath of area in the Northeast, you all of a sudden had Northeast legislators that were also looking for some federal support for rebuilding and recovery. So it became not just an issue that was affecting certain states. And so certainly the wildfires in the West and other issues have really made this much more of a national issue than it probably was before, from a political perspective.
And we're paying a lot more now to clean up so many more of these problems than we did 5 years ago. As taxpayers, it would seem that we all do have an interest in trying to figure out a way to bring the overall cost or the long-term cost of dealing with these issues down as much as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so as an industry, we're certainly promoting the value of building with a material that is fire resistant, that is moisture resistant, that has the strength to resist the winds and the earthquakes and the floods and those types of things. So it's why you have programs in our industry. We've got block strong types of messaging. The National Ready Mix Concrete Association has built a coalition together that is touting build with strength. And so we can promote the values of that. But in reality, we do need the federal government and other groups to help with the rationalization for why the increase in cost to build stronger is going to have long-term benefits for people. Because if you think about it, if you've got a building or a home that can withstand that disaster event, then they can get back into their homes quickly. You've got businesses that can open faster. And that just reduces the cost in not only the recovery element, but it makes sure that you have less economic impacts. Economy is able to continue to generate when stores are able to open and people are able to go back to work.
Speaking of promoting things, you also are underway with an effort to create a marketing program, I think, right, for the materials your members make so that the word can get out on the advantages of using concrete block, other similar types of products in construction. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just to give you a little bit of flavor for our industry, we traditionally have been made up of a lot of small manufacturing plants that are really in most communities around the U.S. So, you know, at this point in time, you know, for what we represent in our industry, our segment of the industry has about 400 companies, about 800 plant locations. And, you know, we're producing maybe 1.1 concrete block and a total of maybe closer to 2 billion units nationwide. But the one issue that does come about as a result of having a lot of smaller manufacturers and smaller companies is they don't have the wherewithal to really generate the marketing and the research dollars that might be needed to help really advance their company and their industry. So as opposed to other industries where there might be very large companies that can afford to do the research and the market promotion and those types of issues, our industry has always struggled a little bit with that. And they're almost making a commodity product in a sense. So, you know, you can make an argument that a concrete block is very similar to a 2x4. It's hard to brand that product, right? Have you ever really gone to a home center store and purchased one of those products based on the brand or the name that's on it?
I'm always looking
Probably not.
I'm looking for the block that's not, you know, been smashed by the guy who unloaded it, or the 2x4 that's straight, you know.
Exactly.
My dad taught me to look down the edge of that thing, make sure it's not warped at all. So, yeah.
Right. When you have companies that are operating in an environment where their product is hard to brand themselves, they have a harder time being able to rationalize and put into the product enough money to support its own promotion. So there's a concept that's out there, which is called a commodity checkoff program, that was put into place originally for agricultural industries, you know, made up of farmers that really were a pretty big industry, but didn't have a really good ability to pool resources to support and to grow their industry. And so we were finally able, after about 7 years of petitioning Congress, to receive authorization for us to create what's called a commodity checkoff program. And there are about 20 of these programs that are out there, most of them under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Softwood Lumber does have a checkoff program. They've been in place since about 2012. And so what you see with industries that have checkoff programs is that they're in a much better position to support the needed promotion work to help grow and advance the entire industry. And we would use it primarily to be able to demonstrate to people the value of building in a more stronger and in a more resilient fashion.
I assume that the capabilities and the uses that your materials, you know, are primed for, that changes over time. So you need to keep the rest of the world up to date on how block, for example, can be applied today versus how it was used 20 or 30 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about masonry is it is probably the oldest building methodology, if you will, on the planet, right? So stone masonry, brick masonry, you know, you can see all kinds of examples in great architecture around the world of masonry construction. And the National Concrete Masonry kind of straddles the fence, if you will, between being a masonry-related industry and a concrete industry. So we use concrete as the material, but the application is more like a masonry product. So typically installed and laid by hand with trade craft workers who can assemble homes and buildings with it. So it's a very ancient craft, but it also has the ability to provide very modern solutions. And you're right, that's one of our challenges and our opportunities is to continue to evolve as a modern building material and to present those solutions to the marketplace.
You sound like a busy guy.
Well, aren't we all? I mean, there's always there's always tremendous opportunities and tremendous challenges, right? And so the idea is to convert those challenges into opportunities.
Well, and your office is here in the Washington, D.C. area, right? So you're over on the Hill a bit, I assume?
Yes, absolutely. We're actually a little bit outside the Beltway. We're out here in Herndon, Virginia, in a beautiful concrete masonry structure, as you can imagine. And so, yes, we do have the opportunity. It's one of the reasons why we're located where we are, so that we have the ability to participate in all the forums and all the environments and to influence all those groups that do reside within the Beltway.
The favorite podcast interview question is the last one, and we try not to overuse it, but we do throw it out there from time to time. Use your concrete ball here, look into the future, and tell us what you see as it relates to how Washington is treating or will be treating the businesses that you represent here.
Well, I would like to think that Congress will figure out this issue on an infrastructure perspective. The big issue has never been if they're going to figure something out. The question is when they're going to be able to get past the politics associated with how you fund an infrastructure project. So it's something where I think the wave is coming, and I do think that they will figure it out. We need a long-term sustainable funding mechanism, and it's not going to be easy, and there's going to be those people who feel like it comes at the cost of something else. But I actually have faith that we'll get there.
Next week, we'll visit with Congressman Pete Stauber to ask him about the promise this new dialogue holds for a financing solution and to get his take on the PAID Act, his legislation to bring greater fiscal responsibility to transportation infrastructure projects. That's Wednesday, May 8th on Hard Facts, a podcast production of the Portland Cement Association. I'm Robert Johnson. I'll see you then.